Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Imagination, a Manifesto by Ruha Benjamin. Read by Janina Edwards. Publisher's note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to images present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Dream a little before you think. Toni Morrison. The map to a new world is in the imagination. Robin D.G. Kelly. Preface. Imagination, by definition, takes many different forms. Still, Merriam-Webster Dictionary comes in handy. The act or power of forming a mental image of something not present to the senses, or never before wholly perceived in reality. In this book, however, I refuse to police the parameters of imagination. I want more than anything for your imagination to run wild. In that spirit, my use of the word is undisciplined, promiscuous, and porous. Although a key term in my academic field of sociology is sociological imagination, referring to the capacity to link individuals' personal problems with broader social processes, my approach here is more unruly. I go back and forth between imagination and imaginaries, conceptual kin, related but not identical. Although a bit jargony, as a noun, an imaginary refers to collective projections of a desirable and feasible future, I find myself invoking imaginaries when I want to cast a critical light on the imposition of a dominant imagination that presents itself as appealing and universal. You'll notice, too, that I refer to imagination interchangeably with dreams and dreaming, ideas and ideologies. I invoke stories and speculation as surrogates, playing and poetry as proxies, and myths, visions, and narratives, all as riffs on the imagination. In most cases, I am implying the idea of a collective imagination, as when we imagine different worlds together, writing shared stories and plotting futures in which we can all flourish. But this collecting of our imaginations is not always a good thing, as when the powers that be endeavor to download their dreams from on high. We must learn to protect our imaginations. Imagination doesn't erase nightmares, says author Imani Perry, but it can repurpose them with an elaborate sense-making or troublemaking. And if imagination can lead to troublemaking, is it any wonder, then, that those in power work tirelessly to squash us from having radical imaginations that dare to envision a world in which everyone can thrive? My conceptual unruliness is sure to frustrate those desiring discipline, but perhaps it is a balm for those avoiding rigor mortis. If, as the great anti-colonial writer Aimé César puts it, poetic knowledge is born in the great silence of scientific knowledge, then I invite you, as a listener, writer, and dreamer, to bring your own poetic understanding of all that imagination is and can be. Introduction. Cutting school. Once a week in fifth grade, I cut school, or so it seemed. On Fridays, I jumped out of bed and threw on the clothes that I had laid out the night before, then raced to the kitchen to pour a big bowl of Cheerios. Cereal devoured, I huffed and puffed, waiting for my mom to get my little brother Jamal ready and then open the front door so I could race up the block to South Conway Elementary School. Arriving just as the 8 a.m. bell rang, I didn't scurry in after the other kids, their backpacks bouncing up and down in the crowded halls. Instead, I boarded a bus waiting just under the flagpole, and together with a handful of other students, almost all of whom were white, headed to a portable classroom trailer at the back of the nearby middle school. There we entered another world, no ringing bells telling us to move to another class, no sitting at desks lined up in rows, no stuffing ourselves with information to be regurgitated on tests. We cut school. Or so I thought. I spent what I considered Freedom Fridays in the Pelican program for students who, I would only later learn, were labeled gifted and talented. At the time, it seemed to me that adults had decided I could have fun once a week. Or perhaps they just wanted us out of their hair. This was, after all, fifth grade. I was the troublesome kid who got up in the middle of class to shush students making noise in the hallway, to the chagrin of the actual teacher. The coolest part of cutting school was that my best friends, Kima and Mary, were in the Pelican program too. We were the only black students selected from our majority white school, where black children made up about 30%. Everything else from those days is a blur. All I remember was the three of us, floating together in a bubble of black girl magic before it was a hashtag. We danced and sang and created poems and plays. Freedom Fridays were full of expressiveness, friendship, and play. The scholar Imani Perry gives voice to what such mental freedom has meant for us. Imagination has always been our gift. That is what makes formulations like "black people are naturally good at dancing" so offensive. Years of discipline that turn into improvisation, a mastery of grammar, and an idea that turns into a movement that hadn't been precisely like that before. That is imagination, not instinct. Pelican was a weekly retreat from the usual strictures of schooling. Worksheets, homework, and tests were replaced by music, movement, and make-believe. But who decided we could steal away? And from what were we escaping? Visiting its website, I learned that there are three pathways into the Pelican program: aptitude, achievement, and performance. The state of South Carolina and the district declares by evaluation and eligibility standards that the gifted child has academic needs that must be met in a differentiated environment. This begs the question, who thrives in an undifferentiated environment? The mission of gifted education is to maximize the potential of gifted and talented students by providing programs and services that match the unique characteristics and needs of those students. So then, is the mission of standard education to minimize or hold at bay the potential of most students? Yes, I think that is precisely what it does, especially if we consider the eugenicist roots of testing and ranking. In the 1920s, the College Board commissioned psychologist and eugenicist Carl C. Brigham to develop the Scholastic Aptitude Test, SAT. Brigham, a Princeton alumnus who had recently authored A Study of American Intelligence, 1923, hailed the superiority of the Nordic race group and warned that with the promiscuous intermingling of new immigrants, the education system was declining at an accelerating rate as the racial mixture becomes more and more extensive. Standardized testing has always been predicated on a racist, classist, sexist, and ableist standard. A world that relies on social inequality to keep its machinery running can only afford for a handful of people to imagine themselves gifted. Gifted equals destined leaders and bosses, visionaries and innovators who have the time and resources to design the future, while the masses are trained to sit still, raise their hands, and take instruction. Doesn't the unbearable hubris and entitlement of many of society's leaders, whether in industry or politics or even do-gooding professions, stem from us being told all our lives that we are special? Or more precisely, of us being made special and treated by the law and culture as the chosen ones? Meanwhile, the majority of normals, to borrow a term from the sci-fi film Gattaca, are expected to take orders, complete tasks, stand in line, clock in and out, punctually, obediently, subserviently. No dancing in the halls, and certainly no daydreaming about a world put together differently. Mary, Kima, and I were gifted, all right. Gifted time and space to imagine differently. Not because we were different, but because we were given a chance to be different. The fact is, exceptional Negroes have always been a staple of an apartheid-like educational system that separates the gifted from the normal, and both from the naughty or underachieving. Sticks and stones will only break my bones, but words can lift or crush me. For some, the existence of exceptional Negroes suggests the system is not racist. But doesn't such tokenistic inclusion, in which a few individuals are given provincial membership into an otherwise exclusive club, maintain the status quo by making it seem more accessible than it really is? Without a handful of black and brown unicorns in honors classes and gifted programs, we might see more clearly the broader patterns of exclusion. We might realize that school tracking perpetuates intraracial segregation, that even when schools are racially diverse, even when they are in the suburban promised land, they often remain deeply unequal. Indeed, the flip side of hoarding gifted, honors, and advanced placement classrooms for predominantly white students is the funneling of black students into special education and remedial programs, what education researchers describe as de facto racial segregation. One activity at Pelican that I remember vividly required us to invent new uses for ordinary objects like scissors, rubber bands, and erasers. Years later, I heard a talk by noted educator Sir Ken Robinson, in which he described a study about how researchers measure genius-level divergent thinking by assessing students' ability to come up with lots of possible ways of interpreting and answering questions. In the study, 1,500 kindergartners were asked questions like, "How many uses can you think of for a paper clip?" At that young age, 98% of the children scored at genius level for divergent thinking. But over the next 10 years, this capacity was schooled out of them. "We all have this capacity," insisted Robinson, "but it mostly deteriorates." Yet, deteriorates makes it seem like a natural process of decay, when really, it is a concerted, organized process of squashing an otherwise widespread capacity to think, know, and imagine. As writer and activist Adrienne Marie Brown reminds us, we are in an imagination battle. The irony, of course, is that the very place where inventive thinking could be, some would say should be, cultivated, is where it gets snuffed out. Except, of course, for the lucky few who get pulled out of school and given an opportunity to diverge, experiment, and make mistakes. Otherwise, if you let your imagination run free, you're likely to get into trouble. In 2013, 16-year-old black teenager Kiara Wilmot did a science experiment, mixing toilet bowl cleaner and aluminum foil in a water bottle. It caused a small explosion on school grounds, and she was automatically expelled. The Florida assistant state attorney charged her with two felonies filed in adult court. The charges were eventually dropped as part of a diversion program that allows people facing criminal conviction to meet certain service requirements instead. However, rather than being allowed back into her honors classes, Kiara had to finish her junior year at an alternative high school, a euphemism, in this case, for a school for bad kids. There, Kiara felt intellectually uninspired. As she shared with the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, "I'm not getting the challenge that I used to have. I don't have homework. There is no German class. And there is no orchestra." It is doubtful Kiara would have been treated with such contempt were she not black, and because of the zero-tolerance disciplinary policies that uphold rigid rules and end up alienating and pushing out many young people. The outsized response to Kiara's science experiment explosion was also fueled by anti-terrorism fervor in the wake of 9/11 and the Boston Marathon bombing. Her project came just 8 days after the latter. Another outcome of these events was an increase in anti-Muslim hatred, which has not waned. According to a 2016 Gallup poll, 38% of respondents backed a new law that would prevent any Muslim from entering the U.S., and 32% supported a special ID for Muslims, including those who are American citizens. These alarming statistics reflect a long-standing racial imagination that infects social life and periodically erupts into the headlines, as it did in the case of Texas teenager Ahmed Muhammad. In 2015, Ahmed was interrogated, suspended, and fingerprinted for constructing a clock inside his pencil case. He used a small circuit board, power supply, and digital display, inventively transforming the case. Dismayingly, his teacher and principal suspected the clock of being a bomb. Through the distorting funhouse mirrors of white supremacy and anti-Muslim hatred, he was deemed guilty instead of gifted, threatening instead of talented. Kiara and Ahmed would eventually meet at the White House at an astronomy night, hosted by President Barack Obama. Yet Kiara's invitation wasn't extended until after online commentary circulated, suggesting she should be bestowed the same honor as Ahmed. As Kiara shared, the White House had invited her not so much because of her science project, but because of what she called the arrest and all the hardships. "I am a woman of color who was pushed out of school." These hardships reveal that Kiara's path to a White House visit is not the Cinderella story promised to many via the gifted and talented route. Kiara shared at a press conference during her visit to Washington, D.C., "To this day, I still get people who harass me about it and call me a terrorist." And she was haunted by a felony arrest, which she was told would take 5 years to clear from her record. Unicorn status is a fickle prize that can be revoked as quickly as it is bestowed. Instead of rallying around individual exceptionalism, we need to see the bigger picture and imagine new systems of education that cultivate everyone's creativity and curiosity. So what is there to do? The most effective means to refute the prevailing ideologies is to do so collectively, crafting new stories, images, ways of interacting, and investments in those who have been denigrated and discarded. To think about the collective also means being okay with less focus on exceptionalism and instead giving all students opportunities to stretch their imaginations. I wrote this book for all the Kiaras and Ahmeds of the world and all those who cross their paths. It is for organizers and artists, students and educators, parents and professors, realists and romantics who are ready to take Toni Morrison's instruction to heart. Dream a little before you think. In this book, I weave together a lifetime of observations about the centrality of imagination in all our lives, lively engagements with people from many different fields who have ruminated on the power of imagination, promiscuous encounters with pop culture and social media where collective imagination is woven and warped, and practical guidance on how we can exercise our imaginations. I draw upon over a decade of teaching that aims to build students' powers of speculation with projects that involve imagining tools, toolkits, and worlds that break with current social hierarchies. In the process, we will confront the little voice in our head whose job it has been to police our own imaginations. A world without prisons? Ridiculous. Schools that foster the genius of every child? Impossible. Work that doesn't grind us to the bone? Naive. A society where everyone has food, shelter, love? In your dreams. Exactly. We need to give the voice of the cynical, skeptical grouch that patrols the borders of our imagination a rest. After all, dangerous limits have been placed on the very possibility of imagining alternatives, insists scholar and activist Angela Y. Davis. These ideological limits have to be contested. We have to begin to think in different ways. Our future is at stake. Imagination is a field of struggle, not an ephemeral afterthought that we have the luxury to dismiss or romanticize. Imagination, a manifesto, is a proposal for exercising our mental and social structures from the tyranny of dominant imaginaries. It is a field guide for seeding an imagination grounded in solidarity, in which our underlying interdependence as a species and with the rest of the planet is reflected back at us in our institutions and social relationships. Look around. Humanity is in the eye of multiple storms. Will we continue shutting off the power of the masses so that a minority of people can stay warm, or will we build the necessary infrastructure so that everyone can thrive? Like author Arundhati Roy, "I believe another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, if I listen very carefully, I can hear her breathing." If I didn't define myself for myself, I would be crunched into other people's fantasies for me and eaten alive. Audre Lorde. Chapter 1. Whose Imagination? When my kids were little, I waged a cold war against organized sports. It started when my older son received a basketball-themed birthday card. It intensified when my younger one was gifted a lovingly sewn quilt adorned with images of footballs, baseballs, and soccer balls. I knew I had a problem when, instead of cheering on the sidelines at one of their games, I sat Scrooge-like in the car. But things really grew absurd when, at a middle school basketball game, I found myself, a prolific point guard in high school, quietly cheering any time my kid, the only black player on the team, shot air balls, got penalties for traveling, and missed elegant passes from teammates. It wasn't that I was rooting against my son, or even that I was against sports writ large. It was more that I was opposed to the fantasies swirling around the black athlete. Brawn over brain, muscle over mind, physical prowess over all other types of ingenuity. Yes, I know, these are false binaries. No one fits neatly within these either-or propositions. But still, I felt embattled against organized sports as it looms over American childhoods and vexed by the flattened figure of the black athlete as it looms over athletics. At every turn, I found myself sparring with the stereotype that black people are good at sports and attempting to slay the eugenic belief in natural ability. I wanted so badly to protect my sons from being conscripted into this culturally assigned role where their identities would revolve around their ability to run, jump, kick, and catch. When I think back on it, I'm tempted to chalk it up to young mama zeal. How else to explain the way I read entire histories of race and objectification into a simple sports-themed birthday card? But then I remember even supposedly positive stereotypes. Asians are smart, Latinos are passionate, indigenous peoples are spiritual, black folks can dance, have a sinister underside. If you are innately gifted at something, doesn't that imply you don't have to work as hard at it to excel? If you are genetically predisposed toward one thing, doesn't that mean you could be inherently deficient in another? Sociologist Patricia Hill Collins describes stereotypes as controlling images because they box us in no matter their valence, negative or positive. The irony is that even when we try to avoid falling into a stereotype, like I was, they are controlling us. Beyond the stereotyping effect, what continues to disturb me about the black athlete is the white entitlement that ensnares this celebrated figure. I think of NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick, who, in 2016, first took a knee during the national anthem to bring attention to police brutality, and the white audiences who demanded he shut up and play while the team owners blacklisted him from the league because he was bad for business. I think of gymnastics champion Simone Biles, who, in 2021, decided to withdraw from the Olympics finals after experiencing the twisties, a frightening experience when gymnasts lose control of their bodies in the air, and the public blowback she received, being called a selfish sociopath and a shame to the country. I think of Kylian Mbappe, who in 2022 led the French national soccer team to second place in the World Cup, and how he and his teammate, Kingsley Coman, were the targets of racist abuse online following the last match, despite Mbappe having performed the extraordinary feat of scoring two back-to-back goals within minutes to tie with Argentina. I think, too, of the countless retired black football players who suffer from dementia, but who, until 2021, were denied settlement awards from the NFL's concussion fund because they were presumed to have lower baseline cognitive function than their white counterparts, simply because they were black. One after another, crunched into other people's fantasies and eaten alive. Picture it. Stadiums full of white fans who cheer on the black athlete, touchdowns, home runs, slam dunks, but who have no black friends, avoid hiring black employees, protest black history in their children's schools. They are happy to be entertained by panting black bodies, but they look away from the brutality meted out to breathless black people off the field. I think of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin, who, in 2012, was making a snack run when he was shot dead by George Zimmerman in a Florida gated community at the very moment when millions of Americans were rooting for their favorite, mostly black, players during the NBA All-Star Game. A deadly hypocrisy, as I see it, when it comes to how blackness is selectively celebrated and contained within the white imagination. Know your place aggression is what scholar Coretha Mitchell calls it when the success of marginalized groups is met with backlash. This certainly applies to Serena Williams and the unrelenting disdain that has greeted her lifetime of achievements. In other cases, like that of Biles and tennis champion Naomi Osaka, black athletes are expected to keep performing no matter the cost to their own well-being. Don't you dare step out of bounds, is the warning. Or like with Kaepernick, white aggression is directed at those whose achievements are hailed on the field, but who are deemed a menace when they dare exercise agency in other contexts, especially if they threaten America's idealized representation of itself as the land of the free, home of the brave. These are but a sampling of high-profile instances of adulation turned antipathy. Meanwhile, what some call the college sports industrial complex remains a billion-dollar industry fueled by black talent, TV deals, new stadiums, corporate sponsorships, and ballooning salaries for everyone except the players. Civil rights historian Taylor Branch has uncovered the deep hypocrisy and false benevolence of a college sports industry that romanticizes amateurism and celebrates free education for players, many of whom still cannot afford a movie ticket or a bus ride home. But black athletes are rising up, demanding a say in the governance of their sport, calling for fair compensation, threatening to boycott, and filing class action lawsuits against the National Collegiate Athletic Association. As a young mom seeking to cultivate confidence and courage in my children, not only in the narrow domain of sports, but as they move freely and fully through the world, I struggled against the allure of the black athlete. And it is quite possible that my militancy stems from suspicions that my own father's stroke and early death are linked to his days as a college football player. The irony is that, as young adults, one of my sons walked on as an NCAA Division I rower with no prior experience, and the other was voted captain of his college rugby team. Lusai, I tried. Interesting that they gravitated toward activities that, in the U.S., do not have a large fan base and have very little black representation. The better, perhaps, to experience the highs, lows, and rush of sport without the cheering or jeering of white crowds at their necks. The point remains. Games are serious business. They reflect and reinforce broader social patterns of power and inequality. Take the game Monopoly, which has sold over 250 million units since Parker Brothers began mass producing it in 1935. Most people don't know that the precursor to Monopoly was the landlord's game, created by feminist anti-monopolist Elizabeth McGee. McGee, like so many others at the time, was inspired by economist Henry George's 1879 bestseller, Progress and Poverty. She decided to create a game to demonstrate the evils of monopoly, inviting players to reject the impoverishment and displacement upon which gross concentrations of wealth depend. She applied for a patent in 1903, and 3 decades later, Parker Brothers would pay her only $500 for the rights. Although McGee intended players to experience the game as a fantasy that eats us alive, monopolizing power and resources ends up, for many of us, being the object of desire, not disdain. Those of us trapped inside the capitalist dream are taught to identify with the winner and look down on the losers. Aporophobia is what philosopher Adela Cortina calls the fear, hatred, and rejection directed at poor people. The question is, should we try to change the rules to allow for more winners? Or is it possible to subvert the game, maybe even stop playing, and imagine a social and economic system that doesn't immiserate the masses to enrich the few? Take the board game Co-opoly, launched in 2011, which simulates what it is like to be employed in a worker cooperative in which we either all win or all lose. Rather than warn us of the evils of capitalist exploitation, as McGee had hoped to do with her 1903 invention, the creators of Co-opoly take it a step further by introducing players to the joy and pleasure of cooperative economics. This is a good reminder that we shouldn't shine a light only on the deadly imaginations and social orders that are killing us, but experiment and play with new prescriptions, visions, and forms of social organization.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?